Hello, New Zealand One, and welcome to 30 terrible habits of server and cloud administrators. This is a substantial revision to the talk I did last year. I've thrown in cloud, I've thrown out some of the terrible habits that weren't as terrible as other terrible habits that I've learnt that some of you may have. So why on earth do server and cloud administrators have terrible habits? I mean, surely we're the chosen ones. Surely we're perfect. We're not evil geniuses, but we're geniuses. We are the Morlocks to the developers, Eloy. How do we have such terrible habits? Well, I was getting my house renovated, and the guy renovating it said, "Your house was built by a builder." And I said, "Well, how do you know?" And he said, "Well, builders often live in unfinished houses. Chefs rarely cook extravagant meals when they're at home." Now, server and cloud administrators and everybody in this room recognizes good practice. It's just that we don't all get around to putting it into our production environments. Now, why is this the case? Well, we develop bad habits because, and here's some excuses that you might want to try out just to see if it makes it easier to look in the mirror. We practice reactive administration. Reactive administration is, "Oh look, it's on fire, I better put that out," rather than, "How do I stop the fire occurring in the first place?" I mean, if we lived in a perfect world, we could stop fires before they started. But in reality, everything's burning and we're going to die, we're just sort of delaying it by putting out fires. Through a process of natural selection, server and cloud administrators have developed a natural aversion to pulling on loose threads. I mean, how long are you into your career before you go, "Well, I could turn it off, but it's working, so I'm not going to touch that." Who feels that their infrastructure is a bit like the Millennium Falcon? We don't have time. We're always expected to do more with less. We're automating, we're doing everything. We don't have time to go out looking for problems because problems are already finding us. It's not like we're sitting there going, "Oh, I've got nothing to do today. I'm going to look for trouble." It's like, "Oh gosh, what do I have to do to get out of this?" Okay, we're going to set this up. We're going to put it in a dev environment. What do you mean you're using it in production? No. The proof of concept. It's not meant to be in, and it's in production. And 10 years later, it's still in production. A consultant set it up. The number of times. Why is it like that? "Oh, well, you see, this guy came in from, and he's getting paid a lot, and this is what it's like." It was like that before I got here. That's really a good one. And you're sitting there going, what kind of clowns were running this joint before I turned up? I mean, we've got some premium A-grade clowns now, but what sort of circus was running before? We suspect that our IT infrastructure was built by the professor from Gilligan's Island. And I know that you know who Gilligan's Island are because millennials don't, but there's a lot of moral lessons that were on Gilligan's Island. And it's all about how a meaningful person who was a lot like an IT pro had every plan to get off the island ruined by an idiot in a red shirt and a white hat. Management keeps prioritising silly rubbish that stops people from doing their jobs. I was consulting with a group of people that were responsible for a very senior politician whose name rhymes with rabbit in Australia, mail server. And they said that they could never get the security of the mail server right Because the staff of that senior politician just wanted them to always chase down leaks. And they were saying, if they're going to leak to the press, they're going to use Hotmail, not our exchange server. But that's what happens in a lot of organisations. You get management prioritising things that aren't important because they've got the attention of a three-year-old that's had 15 Red Bulls instead of working on stuff that you need to work on. So why is it important to ensure that you don't continue with bad habits? The first one, the obvious one, security. The next one, cost. Bad habits cost the organisation money. And perhaps most importantly, biting sarcastic observations from your peers about your network infrastructure. So, the first thing to think about, privileged accounts, the accounts you're using on a regular basis, are grail items for people who have nefarious intent. People want to harm your organisation. They've learnt it's a lot easier to go after a person than it is to go after the infrastructure. Hack the nerd is far simpler and far more effective than hacking the system. All you've got to do is get a nerd on a bad day, and I'll click on that link. Do you want to destroy your organisation? Yes, no, I mean no. Malware infection. Your credentials are compromised. A large number of detrimental events in IT occur due to circumstances that were easily preventable by good practice. When you're reading post-incident reports, you're sitting there, and it's certainly someone else, not you, you're sitting there reading going, how could they have been so dumb? How could they have not done that? Okay, so one of the things that we've seen in the recent Assange leaks about the Democratic National Committee's emails is that this guy who was running the DNC, John Podesta, they were doing resetting his password on a regular basis because he forgot it. And they were resetting his password to something like John Podesta 1. So needless to say, looking back on it, is it a surprise that someone was able to pull his entire mailbox? No. So everything looks simple in hindsight, but you need to sort of have that mentality when you're thinking about your own bad habits, your own security configuration. Is there something that I am doing, or is there something that I am not doing that is simply so blindingly obvious in hindsight? Because you don't want to end up in a meeting explaining to frowny people in ties why you didn't do something obvious. Even if that meeting has really, really, really good biscuits. Because if there's one way to get a systems administrator or a cloud administrator into a meeting, it's to cater the meeting well. Because our defences are lowered by the sugar. So let's talk bad habits. Personal email accounts used for the organisational cloud account. The way this happens, we've all heard the story about the exec who is frustrated with IT procedure, who is so frustrated with IT procedure that they go out to a cloud provider with that corporate credit card and they're going to spin up a workload because they don't want to go through all the policies and procedures. Now, what do they sign up for that cloud account with? Their Hotmail account. And then suddenly, more and more resources get moved into the cloud. And then suddenly, the entire organization's cloud infrastructure is running off someone's personal email account. Has anybody ever seen that happen in a friend's organisation? Organisational email address uses as the primary account for an organisational cloud account. Now, that's not so bad, okay? So I've got oren.thomas@contoso.com. That's a reasonable thing to use for my cloud account. But they also use these email addresses to sign up for other things, like Ashley Madison or RedTube. RedTube is an educational site for teenage boys. When the Ashley Madison breach came out, the number of .mil and .gov addresses in it was extraordinary. There were tens of thousands of these addresses. When there was a breach on an educational website for 13-year-old boys, there were a lot of .mil and .gov addresses. I mean, who the heck signs up to those services with their organisational address? So work email, and which these days means work credentials, are very increasingly exposed in breaches. Okay, and we know this because we're getting a lot more information about breaches these days because of the guy on the jet ski. Okay, and I've got a thing about this jet ski, right? I've got a thing about this. This is Troy Hunt. Troy Hunt rides around the Gold Coast on a jet ski, and the reason I've got a problem with it, well, not really a problem, is that my wife sees the life Troy leads, and she goes, "You've written a lot of books. Why don't we have a mansion on the Gold Coast? And why can't you ride around on a jet ski?" And my son's like, "Papa, why aren't you as good as Troy Hunt?" I told Troy that, and he said, "That's good. No one should be that handsome." Anyway, so Advanced Threat Analytics, which is a Microsoft service, actually detects when an organisation's email account's turned up in haveibeenpwned.com, which is the website that Troy runs. And what he does is he sucks in data breaches and he analyses those data breaches for people's email addresses. And you get a notification if your email address turns up in a breach. But you can also sign up at an organisational level to see if anybody in your organisation is involved in a breach. So if you've got, you know, New Zealand secret military installation .co.nz or .gov.nz, because as I have said in many sessions, I'm absolutely convinced that a country that removes its air force must have other methods of destroying Australia. Pardon? Why would you destroy? You see, my brother, my younger brother, is a Kiwi by birth. So maybe I just have this problem psychologically where I have been sort of this the whole time. I'm not touching you, I'm not touching you. And I feel that that perfectly encapsulates the relationship between New Zealand and Australia. Like we send the wallabies over here and it's not, "I'm not touching you, but we're certainly beating you." Multiple admins using a single highly privileged account to manage the cloud subscription. So they sign up for Azure, they sign up for AWS, because we're new Microsoft now, we can actually acknowledge the existence of the competition. But we're using one account. So when someone wants to spin up VMs, they sign on to the account. So everybody knows the email address, everybody knows the password. This is not good practice. You should have separate accounts. Not enabling two-factor authentication on privileged cloud management account. Now, this is really important. Think about it this way. We're moving a lot of our infrastructure from on-prem, where we can go and boot the server, we can see it, it's sitting in our server room, and we're virtualizing all of that infrastructure and we're putting it up in the cloud. And what that means is that anybody who has access to those credentials can do whatever they want to the infrastructure. It's more challenging to go into someone's server room with an axe and destroy everything that way versus simply signing into the account and then deleting all the resources. And believe me, that has happened. There was a contractor in New York who'd done a whole lot of work migrating someone from their on-prem environment to the cloud. And then his billing wasn't sorted out. And he hadn't handed the credentials over yet. And he's saying, "Come on guys, pay me because you owe me." And they're like, "No, no, no, we can't afford to pay you just yet." And he said, "Well, if you don't pay me, I'm going to delete your infrastructure." "No, no, 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 don't do that. We got rid of the on-prem infrastructure." "Then pay me." They didn't pay. He deleted the infrastructure, right? You now live in a world, if you move stuff to the cloud, where someone who's having a bad day can go and delete your entire infrastructure. So you want to make sure that you do something about the way the clouds are being used. At least with two-factor authentication, you know it's someone inside that's doing it. But if these accounts are getting out into breaches, because believe me, the people who are looking at data breaches are then checking to see whether or not those accounts exist in the cloud. Because what do people who like looking in data breaches also like doing? They like spinning up VMs in Azure and AWS and mining Bitcoin. And if they can go and do that on your dime, they much prefer to do so. Keep username. Who has heard of anybody that's done this? Keeping username and passwords of privileged accounts in Word documents or Excel documents. Yes. There was actually a survey that found that 30% of Fortune 500 companies had privileged accounts kept in Word documents where there was a common password. So anybody who could open the document had access to the privileged accounts. Don't do that. And I'll talk about a better solution later on. Not using role-based access control for cloud subscriptions. All of the major cloud providers allow you to have basically a Superman subscription or a Superwoman subscription, and then to configure role-based access control where you can give someone full permissions over a limited set of resources. So you can say, right, you can go and spin up these resources for your department and you can manage them and do whatever you want, but you can't do anything at the full account level. So the billing and things like that, they're handled at a much higher level. And overall control, and you can put quotas in place where you can say, right, this is how many resources you can consume in a monthly period. And this is very important because as one of the other problems that people have, especially with the cloud, is that they overconsume resources. They plan to use a certain amount of resources, they use far more. This is why Microsoft and this is why Amazon really love the cloud, because you go in there and it's like my wife when she goes shopping for shoes. I'm only going to spend this much money. And then we hit reality and we spend a lot more than this much money. And then it's like, why can't Oren afford to get the brakes on the car fixed? I don't know, but someone's got good shoes. Not using privileged identity management in Azure. Now, what privileged identity management allows you to do is that any time an account needs to do something that requires elevation, requires special privileges, it'll be limited to a certain amount of time, and each elevation requires two-factor authentication. So literally when you want to do something like remove a virtual machine, you will get a phone call saying, do you want to elevate privileges? And then you type in a code, and then you've got the ability to go and do that elevated privilege thing. But this provides another level of sanity check. If you were in my just-in-time privileged access management talk earlier in the week, I actually talked about the way the administrative model is going. And this is important, this idea that we use privileges only for a short amount of time rather than having them forever. And that when we want to use them, we have to take an action to make sure that the person who's using those privileges is authorized to do so. It certainly makes account hijacking more difficult. If you're getting woken up at 3 a.m. by someone saying, do you want to allow elevated privileges using your account in Azure? And you're thinking, well, I'm asleep, so something's gone wrong. You'll be able to remediate that. Not applying software updates to infrastructure as a service virtual machines. This is a very, very big problem in the cloud. Because generally, the first adopters of the cloud have been developers. Now, I love developers. Developers are the Eloi to our Morlocks. They ride the jet skis. We service the jet skis, right? But when it comes to doing things like religiously applying patches, they don't even think about it. They think, oh, it's running in the cloud. The cloud provider's looking after it. No, if you're running a virtual machine in a cloud, in fact, there's certain versions of Service Fabric where the moment you spin it up, you're responsible for patching those virtual machines. And people don't realize. They just sort of sit there and go, oh, well, the cloud provider's looking after it. No, you have to investigate whether or not the cloud provider is patching your infrastructure or whether or not you're responsible. Because the moment you deploy a virtual machine, you have to go and make sure that you're updating that virtual machine because no one else is going to do it for you. And people forget that. They think, oh, I'm going to deploy, you know, a Linux virtual machine in AWS or in Azure. And that's going to look after itself. And what they realise is, no, it's not. It'll look after itself initially, but at some point you've got to actually perform those, you know, maintenance tasks that people need to do, like servicing their car. Don't leave VMs running in Azure that you don't need. Who here has, say, a subscription with Azure where it's basically use so many dollars per month and then cut me off? Anybody got something like that? Who here has had their subscription exhausted because they've accidentally left something running in Azure? Okay, now many organisations don't have that cutoff. And I have been in the room while friends of mine that work for Microsoft have had a very uncomfortable conversation with a customer who has accidentally left virtual machines running in Azure and then has got the bill for those virtual machines, and they're saying, well, we didn't mean to, but now apparently we owe several hundred thousand dollars. Okay? So you need to have don't leave stuff running in Azure that you don't need, but have a monitoring solution with any of your cloud subscriptions that's sending you billing information almost on a daily basis so that you can see that sort of thing happening. Because if you know it's going to happen, and there are service providers that provide this in depth, you know, can break it down and send you alerts when you're hitting certain thresholds. If you get an alert that says, okay, did you know that in the last week you've spent $1,000 in Azure, you can respond to that. Or $1,000 might be a lot for some people, and it's basically nothing for other people. Because if you spin up, say, one of the really big VMs that's got, you know, hundreds of gigabytes of RAM, and it's running on solid state disk, and it's got a super GPU on it, yeah, you can blow through money really, really, really quickly. Okay? Microsoft is not providing the cloud for charity. Yes, it can save you money if you use it correctly, but if you don't, Microsoft's going to make a lot of money out of your inattention. So, leaving VMs stopped and not deallocated. This is another trick. With Azure, if you just shut down a VM, you're still being billed for the use of the storage. If you deallocate the VM, you will not be billed for that VM. But what happens is it's going to give up any IP address reservations that it's got. So when you shut down test VMs, but you want to keep them, deallocate them, don't just leave them stopped. Make sure you also go through and clean up resources. If you go and create a virtual network, or if you go and create a virtual network that's got a VPN into it, you are actually still paying for that, even if you are not using it. So work out what you are being billed for in the cloud, and make sure that if you're not using it, you get rid of it. Because it's very easy, when you can create infrastructure at the drop of a hat, not to remove that infrastructure at the drop of a hat. And anything that you leave there, you're likely to get charged for. Okay, so let's move on to something different. Let's call them neglected event logs. And as I ask each time when I come to New Zealand, who here has ever gone into Event Viewer and looked over the list of events and gone, couple of red, mostly yellow, cool, clear event log. Familiar to anybody? Most breaches have involved months and months and months of network reconnaissance. The average is up to something like 285 days where attackers are in your network doing recon before they're detected. These breaches are evident in logs. So I've been talking about the Target hack, which is one of the biggest hacks in terms of credit cards, where they were able, once they went back and looked at their logs, to see that the activity had been going on, that the attackers had been in there testing, touching, looking at things for many, many, many months. So it's likely if someone is attacking you that the evidence is there. But the problem is that administrators can ignore the breaches false positive. They can literally go, well, there's a couple of red ones, there's a couple of yellow ones, we're cool here. Which is not necessarily an unreasonable response, because the other problem with event logs is event logs sometimes are a bit like the boy who cried wolf. Sometimes they seem to that something terrible's going on and there's nothing happening. So we sort of build up a resistance to the fear of an event log. So the solution is that you need to understand what you need to respond to, and you need to understand the difference between a suspicious and anomalous. And that's very easy for me to say up here on stage in front of a big blue slide. It's very difficult, unless you spend a lot of time studying it, to actually get that knowledge. But Microsoft sort of come to the rescue on this. There's a solution called Advanced Threat Analytics, which you may have heard about. And basically what it does is when you spin it up, it puts hooks into everything and it looks for anomalous activity. And it uses machine learning intelligence to go through your logs and find connections between things that are unusual and they shouldn't be there. So it's basically using a big data machine learning approach to find those anomalous things in your logs that you need to follow up on. Because they've got not only the knowledge from your local system, they've got it from all of the other breaches and things that they've known about. So basically, if you point something like Azure Threat Analytics at your logs, it will find something or something similar from a third-party provider. So this is one of the solutions to, oh my gosh, look at the size of that haystack. How on earth will I know that's a needle and it's not just, you know, a cactus thorn? Well, this is about machine learning, really, really good at finding needles in haystacks. Now, service accounts. Service accounts with passwords that do not expire. Who here has set up a service account and configured the password to never expire? That's okay, we've done it, but we shouldn't. A single service account used for all services. Believe it or not, I did a talk with Andrew McMurray earlier in the week on Config Manager. And one of the things that we often find with Config Manager deployments is that there's three primary service accounts that you use. And there's so many organizations that have just created a single user and assigned all of those service accounts to that one user. You don't do that. When you do that, you can't do differentiated permissions on that service account, because basically the way that you assign a lot of rights is that you assign them using group policy. And if unless you're going to do separate things on each server for that one account, and then what if you're using it for multiple services on that account? And people do it because it's easy and it's lazy, but you shouldn't do it. All service accounts in the organization using the same default password that never expires. Anybody here have a friend who uses the same service account password? No, you're all really quiet now, because you've got, I'm not going to say you've got no friends, because that's the easiest way to get one on an eval, but this is what also happens, that, oh, well, we've got a standard service account password, so that we all know it. Service accounts that are members of the local administrators group. So you need to configure a service account that's got to go and have these rights. Well, rather than worrying about configuring those rights individually, why not instead just add them to the local administrators group? Surely nothing could go wrong. Okay, there's a couple of things you need to know about service accounts. Generally, service accounts do not need the log on locally, right? And they need very specific rights. But a service account should never be able to be used to log on to a server interactively. And most people never even think about it. What they do when they create a service account is they go and create a user account, standard user account, put a standard password, configure it not to expire, and then not think anything more of it unless they might need to assign a very specific right to it that will get things working. There will also be advice on how you can lock it down. Do not give it this right. Do not give it the log on as a batch job right in some cases. Do not give it the ability to talk to anybody else on the network. Service accounts in some respects, and Jess pointed this out that she'd seen it in her own organisation, have been added to the domain admins group. Why? Well, that's the easiest way to make sure that the service account works, right? It's not even cool to do that in a development environment, and I know why we do it, because I know I'm constantly building labs out, and sometimes you're sitting there going, well, I could spend 45 minutes configuring each one of these group policies, or I could add it to the domain admins group and everything's going to work in about 2 minutes. And that works really well if you're doing it in a lab and it's a really bad thing to do, but we know that things go from development environments to production environments without necessarily our control. So your solution is that you do need to do the hard work, you do need to investigate things such as group managed service accounts. Now you've heard about group service managed service accounts for a while. These are the service accounts where you set them up. They don't have the log on locally right, They automatically have their passwords updated in accordance with your organisation's password policy. You never know what the password of the service account is, but when you install it, you use the exclamation mark to specify the account. And the computer knows, oh, this is a group managed serviced account. It goes and retrieves the password so that you don't have to type it in. And that way, that service account no longer becomes a point of failure because every service account has the same password. So where possible, go and implement group managed service accounts. Pretty much every supported operating system that's available from Microsoft, and I say supported because I do know that some of you have got Server 2003 and that's bad and you should feel bad. Every supported version of Windows Server supports managed service accounts or group managed service accounts. Bad password management practices for service accounts is not unique as a password management problem. Cloud and on-premises administrator account passwords can often be configured never to expire or are never changed. So if you've got your account that you use to manage Azure, make sure you come up with a way where you rigorously change the password on a regular basis. You decide what that regular basis is, but make sure you do it. One of the worst habits, or one of the most hypocritical habits of server administrators, is that they force every normal user in the organisation to change their password every 42 days, yet configure their own accounts to have unexpiring passwords. Does anybody have a friend that's done that? So you can search for on-prem accounts with non-expiring passwords using this simple line of PowerShell. Search AD account, password never expires. That will show you all of the accounts that are configured not to have their password expire. In some organisations, every default local administrator account has the same password. Does anybody have a friend where this happens at their organisation? Right, there's a tool from Microsoft called Local Administrator Password Solution. What it does is it goes and creates a randomized local administrator password for each machine. You basically can look up the machine when you need to sign on as a local administrator, and you can get the randomized password should you need to perform an administrative operation on those machines. But when every machine has the same local password, what happens is it gets around the organization what that password is. Because someone will see an administrator type it in, or someone will see it, or someone will hear it, and then everybody knows that if they want to install software on their machine, they just reboot, come in as administrator, put in this magic password, and suddenly they've got full access to their machine. It happens all the time. Users are not as stupid as they pretend to be. They're like crocodiles, okay? They're lurking there. They're going to attack just when you're not wary. And, you know, stupid is a really good way of dealing with people sometimes, because if you pretend you're stupid, they will treat you like you're stupid and they will tell you things that they wouldn't tell you if they thought you were really, really smart. And users have worked this out about IT people. That, you know, some of us have what we might call a Sheldon complex from Big Bang Theory. Now, this is an important one. From a security perspective, any device that you use to directly interact with the web and email is a possible vector for malware. Who's heard of the Pwn2Own competition? Okay, Pwn2Own is a competition that's held at CanWest every year. And basically what they do is that they get a stock, something like a stock Surface Book or a stock MacBook Pro, and whoever can come up with a web exploit or a remote exploit that through normal user activity can completely compromise that machine gets to win the machine, so Pwn2Own. There's stuff that comes in through the browser where you can be compromised like that. And you can even be going to sites that are reputable, because it's not the site that's going to be serving up the malware, it's the ad network that the site uses that may have 1 in 80,000 ads run an executable that tries to drop something in on your machine. So the argument here is that you need to have a separation between the machine that you use for your standard activities and the machines that you use to interact with privileged computers. Remember, hack the nerd is simpler and more effective than hack the system. So if you use a device to interact with the internet on a casual basis, never use this device to manage sensitive systems. Okay? If you're using Reddit while logged on as a domain admin to your workstation, this is probably not good practice. It might be interesting, it might be useful, it might harken back to the 90s when we all read Slashdot on our administrative workstation, but it's not how we should do things. Your day-to-day account should not be a member of the local administrators group on the local machine. Again, we do that because we want to have control over our machines. I remember the first time that someone said to me, when I was a domain admin, oh, no, we don't allow you to be a domain admin on this NT4 workstation. I was like, but I know what I'm doing. I shouldn't have to go through the help desk when I want software installed. I can do this myself. This attitude persists in a lot of organisations. Don't ever disable UAC because you find it annoying. Okay, who here has a friend that's disabled UAC? Yeah, okay. Don't do it. It's there for a reason. It's annoying, but it kind of protects you. It's not a perfect protection. No protection is a perfect protection. It's layers, donkey. It's all about layers of protection. The more layers you've got, the better protected you are. Hack the admin is much easier if the admin always logs on as an admin and disables user account control. So, don't use a domain admin account to sign on to a local workstation. So where am I building to with this? Well, what you need to use is a thing called, and this is Microsoft's current advice, you need to start using what's called a privileged access workstation and or a jump server. The idea of a privileged access workstation is it's a specially configured computer, and I'll talk about it in a moment, that you use for administrative tasks. And you don't use it for anything other than administrative tasks. And the reason that you do that is something called a pass the hash attack. What a pass the hash attack does is the malware is able to come in, and you can see a version of it using Mimikatz, and it can go and pull the hash, the password hash, of your user account. And then that can be used to spider across the network and access other things. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that any computer that might be exposed to malware is not going to have any credentials on it that could be used to spider across the network. When I was talking about this the other day, we were talking about the assume breach mentality. It retrieves the hash of a domain admin account, and then it can go and do anything on the network. So, first thing, minimize the use of accounts so that they're only privileged accounts so that they're only used in specific locations. Use a privileged access workstation and a jump server. So with Windows 10, you can enable a thing called Credential Guard. And what Credential Guard does is it's like a special virtual machine that sits under Windows 10, and it holds all of the credentials. So that even if a tool like Mimikatz is run on the workstation, it can't access those credentials. You can also light up a thing on Windows 10 called Device Guard. Who here has heard of AppLocker? Okay, think of Device Guard as AppLocker on steroids. It's hardware-enforced, mandatory code signing of code. So basically, you turn it on, the policy sits in this special protected environment, and it says you can only run code on this computer that is digitally signed. Malware is not going to be digitally signed and authorized in Device Guard. So suddenly you've got this special workstation that you use for admins that can't run anything other than specifically authorized software and where the credentials are protected in a virtualized environment. Now, that's not going to be as fun to surf the web on, and you don't do that, but you do use this specifically for administrative tasks. A jump server is a server that you connect to using, for example, you sign on to that privileged access workstation using your normal credentials, you RDP across to the jump server, and then you can sign into the jump server using elevated credentials. And then you configure the jump server and you configure every other server in your organization so that they can only be managed from connections from the jump server. So the idea is that you're building this secure bridge when you're administering things, so that even if this device has been compromised, the jump server hasn't been compromised. If the jump server's not compromised, your eventual protected, awesome, big server targets aren't being compromised either. You can restrict privileged accounts so that they can only be used from certain computers. So what you do is that you put in place privileged access workstations, and then you lock down these accounts so that they can only be used on those workstations. They can't be used to log onto anybody else's machine except for these ones. And this stops the help desk problem, where you get a help desk person who goes out to a person's computer to fix it, and they sign on using a domain admin account, and then those credentials are sitting on that computer until that user at some stage later goes and surfs to a website that may get infected, infect their computer, and those domain admin credentials come up. You can restrict account sign-in times. So most attacks occur when someone's going into the network and penetrating your network at 3 o'clock in the morning. If you make it so that a privileged account can only be used from 9 to 5, and you can have a break the glass account that's, you know, just in case something really goes wrong and we're here at 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah, we can go and use this one. But the idea is, on average, these accounts can only be used at specific times on specific machines. So what you're doing is you're really, really, really locking things down, and you're making them much more secure. You're making them much more inconvenient, but our attackers are getting better. They're not getting worse. We're not dealing with the same threats that we were dealing with 10 years ago. We're dealing with software that's very sophisticated. What we need to understand is that the tools, our attackers themselves might not be getting smarter. There's still the 13-year-old boy that likes going to the educational website. But what they're doing is they're able to download tools that have a lot more intelligence built into them and can do a lot more. And, you know, you can train a monkey to fly a spaceship. I mean, that's what the early space program was. You can train a 13-year-old to actually do a sophisticated hack if you give him or her the right tools. Don't have Swiss Army Knife admin accounts. And a Swiss Army Knife admin account is one that's a domain admin account, a SQL admin account, a configuration manager account, an Exchange account, and an Azure admin account. Who has a friend who has a Swiss Army Knife admin account? Right, now the problem with that account is the moment that account's compromised, every service that that account has access to is also compromised. So you want to avoid that. What you want to do is, if someone should compromise an account, even if they get access to that one key, they haven't got access to a master key. So you're limiting, at all stages, you're trying to limit the damage that can be done. Ask yourself, should all the accounts in your domain admins group actually be there? And there's an even better answer now, because Microsoft's changing its advice on this. The answer is no, because eventually you should have zero accounts in the domain admins group. You should delegate privileges out, and there should be no accounts there, because you are eventually going to use just enough administration and just-in-time administration to do all of this. Does your organization have an account lockout policy for administrators, or are they exempt to it? If someone logs in twice with the wrong password, or 3 times with the wrong password for an administrator account, do they get locked out? Or can they just keep going and going and going until they get it right? If an admin account incorrectly authenticates 3 times, probably best to lock it and then figure out what happened and then go back and fix it. So with just-in-time privileged access management, as I mentioned, I did do a full session on this earlier in the week. But the general idea is that what you do is you set up a pristine forest that is in a one-way trust relationship with your resource forest. All of the admin accounts are standard user accounts in the privilege forest, but they're assigned administrator privileges in the resource forest. So the advantage here is, if someone goes and compromises that account, they can't go back up to the resource of the privilege forest and then add more users with privileges there. So you've got a pristine set of accounts. What you can also do is allow time-based administrative privileges. So these accounts in this forest, in the pristine forest, only get elevated with permissions for a certain amount of time in the resource forest. So it might be for 60 minutes. And for 60 minutes, that account can add people to groups. Now, after that 60 minutes expires, it can't. And the person has to go back and request through a Rev interface the permission to do the next administrative step. But the advantage of that is it's all logged. You've got everything logged. You're following down on everything, and you're limiting those privileges. So just enough administration is even further. So I'm talking about removing people from the domain admin script. What you do with just enough administration is you create a special PowerShell endpoint. People connect to that endpoint using a standard user account. That then spawns a virtual account for that session that has local administrator privileges. But for that session, only certain PowerShell commandlets can be used with certain parameters and certain values. So the demonstration I did earlier in the week showed someone with a standard user account signing onto a DNS server and having permissions to restart the DNS service, but couldn't restart any other service on the box. So that's just enough administration, and that's where things are going. And this is where you need to be prepared to go, and if you watch that session from earlier in the week, you'll have a much better idea of where things are going. Disabled Windows Firewall. Who here has ever disabled Windows Firewall because they couldn't get around to figuring out what the right firewall rules were? Okay, who's got a friend? So what you do is you enable firewall logging. Jessica Payne did a session on this yesterday in this room, really cool hints about how to deal with Windows Firewall and make it work for you. GUIs on servers that don't need GUIs. The whole point of Server Core and Nano Server is that by introducing a GUI to the server, you massively increase the attack surface of that server. And the reality is today that the vast majority of your servers do not need GUIs on them because you remotely administer them using the remote server administration tools. You don't need to have a head on a DC because no one should be RDPing onto a DC. No one should RDP onto a DC, right? What they should be doing, the DC shouldn't have a head. They should be using remote server administration tools, Active Directory users and computers, Active Directory Administrative Center, and they should be making a remote connection to that DC to perform the operation. They should never actually be signing on, because if they're signing on, they might get bored. And, oh, look, Internet Explorer, Reddit, nowhere. Expiring CA certificates. Make sure you know when your CA's certificate expires and make sure you renew it, because no certificate can be issued from your CA that has a lifetime that exceeds that of the CA certificate. Use tools such as Operations Manager to actually keep track of the lifetime of all of the certificates in your organisation. There are so many organisations where you literally hear, oh, their certificate's expired and now they're offline for, you know, a certain number of hours. Make sure that doesn't happen to you. You can go and track these certificates and you can make sure that you're renewing these certificates before they expire. There should not be a certificate in your organisation that you manage that expires without you knowing about it. Make sure that you are diligent, not only in applying software updates to the operating system, but to the applications in your organisation. What tends to happen, what you may have had a friend do, is your friend may never have applied a service pack or a software update or a hotfix to an application such as Exchange or Configuration Manager until they've hit a problem and then they've gone onto Google, how do I fix this? Oh, that's fixed in CU Update 4. Oh, I guess I better go and apply that update then. Right, you've got to patch your applications as well as your operating systems. Lack of recovery drills. Who here has a friend who hasn't had a recovery drill in the last 6 months? You don't know that your data's backed up unless you've recovered it. Okay, it exists in a quantum state. It may work, it may not work. Back 15 years ago, Microsoft did a whole lot of data on its own MSIT backup and recovery and found that 17% of all backup and recovery operations failed. Either the backup failed or the data was unrecoverable when the recovery came in. Now, that was back when we were using tapes, which were a lot less reliable, but there's still going to be somewhere between a 1 in 20 and a 1 in 30 chance that a recovery is simply going to fail because of something that you don't realise that you haven't got your backups right or there's something else going on. You need to do these on a regular basis just to know that they're going to work. And just moving to the cloud. The cloud's actually an incredible challenge for backup because people think, oh, well, it's up in the cloud, it's looked after. No, it's not. Someone deletes that VM, it's gone. If you haven't got a backup of that VM, bye. If you've got a database up in the cloud and you're using SQL Azure and someone goes and drops a table, do you know how to recover it? You should. Because if you're going to move, if all of your infrastructure is going to be moved to the cloud, you've got to have ways of doing those same boring IT tasks of backup and recovery that you did on-prem. If your cloud provider goes down, okay, so we've got Australia Southeast and Australia East. If the great New Zealand military machine decides to nuke Sydney and Melbourne, what's going to happen to your data? I mean, you can't go down to Wellington and yell, is it still the beehive? You shouldn't have nuked Australia, I didn't get my data out. If you don't know your data is protected until you can recover it, make sure you are auditing your administrators. So quis custodiet ipsos custodes, who watches the watches, right? You're in charge, you need to be tracked. Why do you need to be tracked? Because the majority of detrimental attacks usually come from administrators. Edward Snowden was an administrator at Bose Allen Hamilton. That's why he could get so much stuff. Unwillingness to document. Unwillingness to document is actually good for me professionally because I write systems administration texts. And the reason that I'm okay at it, but I don't have a lot of competition. Why? Because you tell systems administrators that they've got a choice between getting a tetanus injection and then documenting a procedure or a software installation, they go, fire me up, doc. Lack of configuration documentation. Well, it looks like that, but we don't know how to build it. Lack of change documentation. Did you change something? Yep. What did you do? Oh, I'll get to that. Ensure that your environment is documented so that it's comprehensible. If you get hit by a bus tomorrow, after this long period of mourning at your organisation where, you know, they finally stop wearing black and their heart doesn't hurt and ache from your lack of your presence, they're going to need to know how to do things. Make sure that they do know how to do things. One of the solutions that we're seeing more and more implemented is we're seeing configuration management tools such as desired state configuration and Chef, so that we're moving to configuration as code, so that we can spin up our configuration from these Chef recipes or these desired state configuration scripts, and then basically it can go and build it for us automatically. So perhaps we have moved past the day where you have to sort of sit there in front of Word just looking at the blinking cursor thinking, I've got to write 15 pages of documentation about how to build this server and I'd really rather be doing something else. Well, if you've got all of the configuration code so that someone just has to run a Chef recipe or run a DSC script and that'll automatically build the server, that's good. It's even better because that allows you to enforce the configuration. If someone wants to change the configuration, they actually have to go and change the Chef or change the desired state configuration. So it's all in a way that's documented. And that's another thing that's coming down the pipe. In the next 10 years, this is how we're going to do server configuration. We're going to move away from sitting there with a long list of pages where we read through, right, we've done that, now we need to move that. Is that we're just going to point a recipe or a desired state configuration script at a server and it's going to automatically go and configure itself over a bunch of reboots. Comatose physical servers and comatose virtual machines. There was a survey done that found that 27% of organisations have comatose infrastructure. That is, servers that are sitting in production, VMs that are sitting in production, that no one knows what they do, but they're still there and no one, everybody's afraid to turn them off. You're paying for those. What you need to do is you need to have a way of monitoring VMs and physical server activity. Not just that there's a heartbeat and that it's running, is it actually doing anything? And if you find one of these machines that you suspect is comatose, what you've got to do is you've got to shut down the server, you've got to shut down the VM that appear to have little or no utilisation because you've got a reason to do that. It's costing your organisation money and capacity. Search for all accounts that haven't signed on for 90 days. Find accounts that are no longer being used and disable them. If it's not being used, it can be disabled. But what you don't want to do is leave an account there because you're not sure whether or not it's still being used. Again, when people leave the organisation, they don't necessarily tell IT that they're about to leave the organisation. Sometimes HR informs you, sometimes they don't. But many attackers have gone in and used VPN accounts that should have been disabled months after they've left to come back into the organisation to get a bit of revenge for the reason that they were let go. The solution is to tear off the band-aid. Disable the account, shut down the unused server on VM and see what happens. Do something and respond to the screens. Or as in polite company, we call this DevOps. Aspire to be proactive rather than reactive. The vast majority of security breaches could have been prevented by good administrative practice. The professor could have escaped Gilligan's Island if he had Troy Hunt's jet ski. Good administrative practice will save your organisation money in the long term and reduce the chance of your own resume refreshing event. Thank you very much.